Okay, last chance to come and get a textbook until the end of the lecture, when you can come and get a textbook then, if you signed up. And I was saying in the email I sent out that if there are others who, after they look at the textbook, say, you know, it would be nice to have that, I'm willing to pay something for it, I can urge, if several of you could get together, or obviously you can get a hold of the PDF file for it without any trouble, and go to a cheaper coffee shop, you can possibly get it for less. I just didn't have the energy to go running around all over the university district to different coffee shops, getting them to bid against each, come back to Kinko's and say, will you meet this bid, which I probably would have. So, anyway. All right. We were dealing with different gene frequencies in the two sexes, in which case you get proportions that turn out, I wrote them down here, and I didn't summarize them up, but if you were to look at the resulting genotype frequencies, you see 0.24 for big A, big A, 0.62, adding up these two, for heterozygote, and 0.14. And those are not Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And what we're going to find out is that they have too many heterozygotes, at least in this two allele case. So let's do a little algebra to show that more generally. And I think I can take care of this topic pretty quickly and go on to sex linkage, which is mathematical fun. Okay, so what would happen if you had male, let's see, female gametes with frequencies P sub F, and I'll make this 1 minus P sub F since they have to add up to 1. Over here, P sub M, these are the male gametes, 1 minus P sub M. And then you just multiply, because you're just combining a random gamete from male gamete with a random female gamete. And the homozygotes of the product, PM, PF. This heterozygote is PM times 1 minus PF. This one is 1 minus PM times PF. That's a different quantity. And this one is PM. So 1 minus PM times 1 minus PF. Okay. Now, summarizing those, you get, just add them all up. Those are. How can we show that those are not Hardy-Weinberg proportions? Well, one of the things we can do is just take a quantity, I'll call it delta. Now, I have to get this consistent with what I put in the notes. So, moments, patience here. Take the average of these, of PM and PF, so it's, and I compare it to the value PF, let's say. So I'm saying, how does PF differ from the average of the two? Okay, that's just, so we're going to say, let me call this little p without a subscript on it. Then P PM, let's see, PF will be equal to P plus delta. I'm just moving the term there. PM will turn out to be equal to P minus delta. So delta is just a sort of measure of how different are the PM and the PF as compared to a gene frequency halfway in between them. Now, if I put those in here, these expressions, and I plug them in, what I'm going to get here is P plus delta times P minus delta. So that will be P squared minus delta squared. So P plus delta times P minus delta, you may recall from secondary school, is that. It turns out this one is 1 minus P squared minus delta squared. And this is the Hardy-Weinberg quantity plus twice delta squared. So in other words, whatever delta is, the difference between male and female frequencies, it's actually half the difference between the female and the male frequency, to be precise in this case, that quantity will get, the square of that quantity gets subtracted off the homozygote frequencies, and that amount gets added in to the heterozygote frequencies. So the conclusion is, since delta could be positive or negative, depends on which frequency is higher, male or female, but whether it's positive or negative, its square is positive. So you subtract something positive off of the homozygotes, you add something positive onto the heterozygotes, there are too many heterozygotes. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is, can we figure out what will happen in future generations? And it turns out we can, but there is a very simple, first of all, there's a very simple conclusion we can draw without doing any algebra. Here, I had the male and female frequencies different, and we ended up getting adults, newborns, let's say, in the next generation that are out of Hardy-Weinberg proportions. What's going to happen in the next generation? First of all, for these offspring, are the male and female gene frequencies different for the offspring? And the answer is no. Assuming that this gene, whatever it is an autosomal gene, is not on a sex chromosome. Because here the offspring body didn't say whether they were male or female, and whether they're male or female is assigned by some sex chromosome doing its thing or some other sex determination system. Whatever it is, it's independent of this. And these will be both true in the males and in the females. So now we have a situation where you're not in Hardy-Weinberg proportions, but the two sexes have the same genotype frequencies. What do we know about that? What happens if you make that? Well, that's just the starting point we started from in our Hardy-Weinberg. Just three arbitrary frequencies, but they're the same in males and females. And we know what happens there. You go into Hardy-Weinberg proportions. So what happens the sexes having different gene frequencies is, for one, in the first offspring generation, you're not in Hardy-Weinberg proportions, but thereafter you are. And thereafter you go into the ordinary situation, everything's boring, the gene frequencies aren't changing. Well, what about the gene frequencies? What is the gene frequency in the next generation? We know PM and PF, what PM and PF are. And what we're going to find now is, working in the middle of the board here, the new gene frequency in the next generation. We don't have to put a subscript F or M on it because it's the same in both sexes. And what is it? Well, we just sort of calculate it. We say it's the frequency of homozygotes plus half the frequency of heterozygotes, PM times 1 minus PF, plus PF times 1 minus PM, and you look at that and say, oh, is that going to be ugly? And the answer is no. Because when you expand it out, what you'll find is there's some terms that have a product of PM and PF, and they are 1 times PM PF, minus a half times PMPF minus another half of PMPF. Conclusion, the PMPF term disappears. And now you just have to have the other term. That's a half PM plus a half PF. In other words, the simple average of the two parental sexes, of the gene frequencies in the sexes, is the gene frequency in the offspring. And we know that those offspring then just behave like well-behaved, tardy Meinberg entities. And so that gene frequency then holds for the rest of time in the simple model of mating with no other evolutionary forces present. So now you might say, okay, well, that's fair. You may fall into the trap. It'll lead you into the trap of saying, well, it's fair because we know they're equal numbers of the two sexes, and so you're just weighting everybody the same. And that's not true. Yeah.
Are we assuming that males and females have the same young individuals?
You got it. I said this is not a fair weighting of individuals because of exactly what you said. Males and females might not be in equal proportions in this population. You might have twice as many males as females. You might have six times as many females as males. All this math will work. It will work just fine. And the weighting will turn out to be a half, not because that's how many individuals there are in each sex. There aren't, necessarily. Why? Can anybody come up with a rationale for why half is the right weighting?
We're just talking about the allele frequency?
I'm not sure that convinces me. We're talking about the allele frequencies, but why not just simply count every allele in the population, whether it's in a male or in a female, equally when we get the allele frequency? Does this seem fair? Are you trying to be unfair?
I mean, regardless of what the numbers are, offspring are going to have their alleles half from males, half from females.
Exactly. Because what will happen is the contribution to the next generation of all the males is equal to the contribution to the next generation of all the females. Because every offspring has got one gene from each. Which means, actually, if there are fewer males than females, the males per individual make a bigger contribution. If there are fewer of one sex, those individuals make a bigger contribution as a result of the requirement that each offspring have one male and one female parent. So that's where the one half comes from. Now there's the other thing one can say. Let's see. Right. I think that's all I'll say about this. I do want to just say one more thing. I will say one more thing, which is, you may say, well, this is all very well, but you're not going to run into this situation very often, are you? I mean, you ruled out selection and mutation and migration. You ruled out all these evolutionary forces, but you had the male and female unequally in gene frequency. Well, how often does that actually occur? And the answer is more often than you might think, because sure, in general, you may not be able to rule out all those things. But if you're making a model and you're working out the mathematics of going from one generation to the next, when there is selection, and suppose selection is acting differently in male and females. Is that me? No, that's a spammer. That's not a member of family. Okay. So, I was being very spellbinding and I forgot where I was. Okay, yes. Natural selection can be acting, and you're working your way through a life cycle, and you've just passed the point where natural selection occurs, and it's changed the genotype frequencies in the males, let's say, but not in the females, or maybe the other way around. So now, right after natural selection, you've got different gene frequencies in the two sexes. And you're going to work your way forward and say, well, they're going to mate and they're going to make offspring. What are those going to look like? And you're going to have to do this. So then it will be true part of a generation. And so doing the math, it's the same math. And we'll be seeing that with respect to Hardy-Weinberg itself. We can have situations where natural selection changes the genotype frequencies in both sexes. And now you're not in Hardy-Weinberg proportions, but then you go to mate. And for that moment, the offspring are in Hardy-Weinberg proportions up till the point when they get to the selection in the next generation. So during a part of a generation, the ordinary Hardy-Weinberg is relevant, and and when the gene frequencies are unequal selection, this is relevant. Okay. Anyway, enough of that. What I want to do is whiz on to sex linkage, which is fun. It looks just like this, except now there is a relationship between what genotype you are here and what sex you are, and that changes things. So let me...
There's not equal contribution.
What's not equal, sorry?
Not equal contribution.
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. I mean, it's still true there are equal contributions of chromosomes, but some of those chromosomes are not going to contain alleles. So let me erase everything from here on over. And... we'll start with sex linkage. Now, there are many sex determination systems, but a whole class of them act like XY in the respect to the math that we're going to do. There are others like temperature-dependent sex determination, which is found in a lot of reptiles, where this math won't be relevant because there isn't a sex chromosome. But there's some like haplodiploidy, which is common in social insects, for example, or it's in Hymenoptera. And there, every chromosome is a sex chromosome, in effect. So it is tremendously relevant to that. But I'll just consider an XY sex determination system. And of course, we have XY is male, XX is female. Birds and butterflies do it the opposite way around. All the math will be the same. It's just you change the label on which one you call the male and which one you call the female. Okay, so the gametes coming from the males will be X and Y. All the gametes coming from the females will be X. I probably don't really need two rows there. I can do just one row. Now suppose that in the males, the gene frequency in the males, now remember the genes are just on the X, there's a tiny little pairing region of X and Y in humans that I'm not going to discuss, but for a sex-linked gene, it's on the X and it's not on the Y. So if we have a gene frequency of P sub M, so I'll just go to gene frequencies, the frequency of big A on the X's will be, let's see, P sub M. I think maybe the best thing to, I'm sorry to mess up anything you're drawing here. This is all, things like equivalent to this are in the notes. How should I do this? I'm going to consider, let me do it this way. In these boxes, you're going to have either a big A coming from the X or a little a. That will happen a fraction PM of the time and 1 minus PM of the time. From the females, you will have Sorry. X is coming with a big A, P, F of the time, and a little a, 1 minus PF of the time. Okay. So now you can sort of work out, in here, you get a diagram in this box. Well, what do the things in this box look like? And the answer is, they look exactly like this one, except I've got the females on top and the males along the side here. So it's flipped. But basically, it's the same math as in... as in the case of unequal gene frequencies in the two sexes. So this will be PM times 1 minus PF, and this will be 1 minus PF times 1 minus PM. Okay. In the male, those are the female offspring, because they're the XX. Here we have the male offspring. And what are they? Well, nothing is coming. No genes are coming from the Y. And the genes are coming from the... So I'll say big AY and 1 minus PF little AY. Okay. So those are the frequencies we expect. And if we now make gene frequencies, we say, what is the gene frequency in the female offspring, and what is the gene frequency in the male offspring? Well, in the female offspring, you have to get the gene frequency from these boxes here. We did that. We went through all that algebra. We canceled out the PMPFs. And so the gene frequency among female offspring in the offspring generation, we'll put a prime on it, and this is the first... We are starting to put primes on things for the new generation. That's a little different from the antique mathematical convenience, which puts primes on derivatives. This isn't the derivative. It just means it's the next it's the thing in the next generation. It's the gene frequency of these, and we already saw that that's a simple average of the male and female frequencies in the previous generation. And for a good reason, because of all the X's that we have in these XX's, half of them came from the males and half of them came from the females. And again, this doesn't have anything to do with whether there are more males than females or more females than males. It holds in those cases. What's P sub M in the offspring generation? So everybody take a look at what's up there and tell me. What is the gene frequency among X's in the males? The X's that came, that are now in males. Here's the offspring generation. What is the gene frequency of big A's in these male offspring among the X chromosomes, because there's nothing on the Y?
Yeah.
Sorry?
PF.
Okay. So what we have is the female frequency is the average of the two, but the male frequency is the previous female frequency because it's got those X's from the females. So now we can take a look at what it looks like. This diagram is shown in the notes. Here's some generations. So this is time. This is the gene frequency, and I'll go to plot separately the male and female gene frequencies, going from 0 to 1, and I'm going to take a case where PF and PM in the initial generation are 0 and 1. So I'm going to take a case where we have an allele and it's all the males carry it, none of the females carry it. And we're going to ask what happens in the future, because this will give us a good feeling for what's the total contribution of the males and the total contribution of the females to the future generations. Okay, so in the initial generation, let's see, I'll do one of these blue, I'll do one red and one green. The males will be 1, and the females will be 0. And now we say, well, what's in the next generation? The females will be the average of the two. That's a half. The males will be the previous females. That's zero. So now the females who are red in this are at 50%. The males are at zero. Whoa. What happened was the male frequency dove down to zero and the female frequency rose to one half. Okay, I'm trying to hand draw straight lines, it's not so easy. Okay, next generation, generation two. The female frequency is the average of these, or the average of a half and zero is a quarter. Maybe it looks like the big A allele is disappearing, is it? Well, the male frequency is the previous female, so it's a half. So what we get here is the female frequency has dropped to a quarter, and the male frequency has risen to one half. So they're switching. They're switching places back and forth. They're also getting closer together. Now, I'm drawing this rather badly. So let's do one more generation. Average of a quarter and a half is 3/8. The average of the previous female frequency is 1/4. So now we have to do 3/8 and 1/4. So 3/8 and 1/4 there. There they are. So they're switching back and forth and back and forth, but they seem to be getting closer together. And in fact, they are. I'll do one more generation just to verify that. Generation four, the average of 3/8 and 1/4 is 5/16. And then the previous is 3/8. So 5/16 and 3/8 are 5/16 and 3/8. Now the plot is in the book and that's online. There they go. So they're converging on each other. How quickly are they converging? What's the difference between them? Well, the difference between them is -1 for the first generation, +0.5 for the next generation, -0.25. And this, if you go 3/8 and 2/8, it's +1/8. And this is -1/16. And you can see what's happening. The difference between them is being cut in half every generation, but it's switching sign. So there's this weird wobbling in a discrete generation's life cycle in which the male and female frequency is bouncing up and down, but they're changing places and they're getting closer and closer to each other. Now you might say, well, what is it going to in the long run? It's approaching something, but what is that something? You could see that if in some generation they become the same, then this average will be equal to that quantity, and so will this one, and so then they'll never change. Once they get to be the same, they won't change. But how quickly will, what's the same, the thing that's the same that they're approaching? By the way, they never come, in the theory, in the mathematics of an infinite population, they never get there. They switch places and the differences become less and less and less and less, but of course never become exactly zero. So what is this? Now, I didn't draw it completely accurately here. What is that quantity? Well, I'm going to show you what it is, but I can only do the math that I'm showing you because I know the answer in advance. There is, yeah.
Does it remind you of like a harmonic oscillator with damping or something?
Yeah. It's the harmonic oscillator damping. Of course, it has momentum. It's swinging across, but not as far and across, like a pendulum damping down.
Okay.
Yeah. But this has no momentum. is jumping all the way in one generation. Yeah, it goes in jumps. Because if it had momentum, then having change down here, you'd go further down. But you don't. In fact, in general, evolutionary systems don't show momentum. Because the next generation, if you have discrete generations, the next generation is produced by whatever we have in the current generation without regard to where you were before that. So whereas in a physical system, if we throw a ball across the room and I take a photograph and the ball is hanging in midair, you can't know where it's going without knowing something about momentum. If you see the photograph, you don't know if it's going left or right or standing still or just falling. In a genetic system, if you take a photograph of what all the genes are and everybody's genotypes, you can predict what happens in the next generation from, say, random mating. Okay, I happen to know that the thing we should look at, and I'll just say for those who are into mathematics, these are linear difference equations, and there's a standard machinery involving matrices for them, and you can do it, and you get the answer that I'm going to give. But the answer...
Linear what equations?
Called linear difference equations. And so let's consider the quantity P that's two-thirds the female frequency plus one-third the male frequency. I happen to know that that's the magic quantity. We could consider it as some arbitrary weights that have a variable name and then solve for the right one. That's what the linear difference equation stuff does. And now we can say, well, what happens in the next generation? If we compute that same weighted average in the next generation, what will it be? Well, all we have to do is take these equations right here and plug them in for PF and PM. For PF, we plug in PF prime, which is this. So it's two-thirds of what? A half PF plus a half PM. And one-third of the male frequency, which is the old female frequency.
This is to find what quantity they're approaching.
It's magically going to turn out to be the quantity that they're approaching.
Okay.
And I happen to know that, and that's why I was able to choose the numbers two-thirds and one-third. So, but let's see if it works out in some nice way in the next generation. And the answer is, well, you plug the stuff in, and then you collect, and you've got two-thirds times a half plus one-third, and that will be two-thirds PF. And then the PM will be one-third PM. So it says that this weighted average of two-thirds of the females and one-third of the male frequency is the same in every generation. Whatever it was in the previous generation, that's what it'll be in the next generation. So it is this dotted thing here. It's two-thirds PF plus one-third PM. And we saw that in the initial population, that will be equal to one-third in this particular case. So this in this thing, they're all approaching one-third. And what that means is that the original males will end up making a one-third contribution to the ultimate genotypes, and the original females will make a two-thirds contribution. And once again, that's not because we're counting X chromosomes and treating them fairly. In fact, there may be many more males than females. But it doesn't matter. The math works out the same because each offspring has to have one male and one female parent in this. Okay, so you get this weird switching around. They converge on each other. But there's a sort of long-term gene frequency that they approach. And that's got by this weighted average. And it counts the females two-thirds and the males one-third. Now, what about Hardy-Weinberg proportions? If you look at this, you'll say, first of all, are there Hardy-Weinberg proportions in the male in the males? That's a trick question.
We're only counting X's.
In the males, are there Hardy-Weinberg?
The parent generation?
No, well, the whole thing is the males have just a single X. So even asking what the diploid genotype frequencies are is irrelevant. They don't have it. They're not diploid. They're haploid.
Yeah.
Okay. How about the females? Will the females be in Hardy-Weinberg proportions?
You mean will their thing stay the same every generation?
Well, also, is it in the p squared 1 mi- 2p 1 minus p 1 minus p squared proportions, the Hardy-Weinberg proportions? I see many people nodding. I nod this way. No. Why? Because in each generation here, the male and female frequencies are at least a little different. And the math is exactly the same as when you have male and female frequencies different, and we established that those are not in Hardy-Weinberg proportions. So as the two frequencies switch back and forth and approach each other, they're never in Hardy-Weinberg proportion, but they're getting closer because the two gene frequencies are getting closer to each other and this delta thing is getting smaller. So that's what sex linkage does. It does has weird oscillations. It's worth remembering how the math works in case you ever have to deal with like natural selection on an X-linked gene. Then it becomes relevant. Most of the time, one doesn't run into this, but and of course, in birds and butterflies, it works the same. But we just switch which is called male or female. In haplodiploid insects, every chromosome, the males. How's it work? It's the males that are haploid and the females that are diploid. And so it's kind of like an XY system, except every chromosome is part of that sex determination system.
If you have linkage disequilibrium on a...
What is linkage disequilibrium?
It means that you have an allele that is linked to another allele.
Yeah, but we're about...
You can't have that at one locus.
You're ahead of us. You're getting ahead of us. I'm sorry to be dismissive of the question, but... we're about to get to it, and I will explain all of that. Okay. Any other questions concerning XY? You know, sex chromosomes or unequal frequencies in the two sexes. Any? Of course, I did this for two alleles. You can make the same thing work for multiple alleles. You'll have much the same math, but for multiple alleles, it's not even in the book, but you can do it. Okay, now we're going to go on to linkage disequilibrium. And I'm going to now talk about the topic of association between alleles at different loci, which is something that came up in the late 1910s originally. The guy who first worked it out was a protozoan geneticist named H.S. Jennings, Herbert Jennings. In the 1910s, he sat down to say, okay, we know about linkage and we get a multiple loci. Let's look at two loci and ask how they will be inherited together. And he did the math, and he did it correctly. And he got the resulting results. Then there was R.B. Robbins, a math professor in Maine, I think, cleaned up the math and got the quantity that everybody uses, which is the measure of linkage disequilibrium. But it was actually Jennings who got this worked out. Jennings, I should say, is an interesting guy because I'll show you a picture of him next time. He did a couple of these population genetics papers, but he did one on full-sib mating, a repeated inbreeding system of full-sib mating, and he got it wrong. He made an algebraic mistake. And then Sewell Wright, one of the great people of population genetics, came along a year or two later and published a paper saying, you were wrong, here's the correct analysis. And Wright was so much more powerful in his thinking that Jennings retreated from the field and never published another population genetics paper after that. And you may say, oh, what a tragedy, but not actually, because Jennings was the earliest person working on the genetics of a protozoa. I cannot remember if he worked on Paramecium or Tetrahymena. He worked on one of the ciliate species, I think Paramecium. And then when I was training, the big person in Paramecium genetics was Tracy Sonneborn. And Tracy Sonneborn was a student of Jennings. And a little later in my graduate work, there's the work of David Manny, who did much more powerful work, and he was a student of Tracy Sonneborn's. So Jennings did fine. He went back to experimental work and did great things, and gave rise to all modern work on the genetics of ciliates. And Robbins, I think, went into administration or something. He did a couple papers and then disappeared into administration. Let me talk a little bit about, in the remaining time, about how you think about more than one locus. And this is tremendously relevant to sequencing of closely linked sites and haplotypes, which is more modern terminology. But if somebody sits down and says, well, how do I think about what sequences of multiple sites will do in a population in the presence of some recombination, tight linkage but recombination, this thing I'm going to talk about is the way to think about it. So we start by making space. I'm going to go completely over here. And what I do is to say, I'm going to talk about gametes. And then we'll talk about genotypes later, not this time. I'm going to consider a case where you have two alleles at the A locus and two alleles at the B locus. This will be one of the few appearances of B in this class. So that there are four possible gamete types. We're back to autosomal genes. You could have a gamete with a big A and a big B, or a big A and a little B, or a little A and a big B, or a little A and a little B. And of course, in the DNA world, those would be base names, not allele letters, but it all works out the same. And I'm going to ask, what happens in the next generation? Suppose I have a population, it's producing gametes, we're back in the world of male and females have equal frequencies of everything, so we're not thinking about that. And they're making a gamete pool. We can think of random mating as everybody throws their gametes into a giant cauldron, we stir thoroughly and draw out pairs and make diploid offspring. And if you do that, then you'll see, you can look in the offspring and say, what fraction of the chromosomes you see there, or the gametes that they would produce, are going to have, let's say, big A, big B. So what I'm going to do is consider it's really a haplotype frequency, or gamete frequency. I'll say equals gamete frequency. And I'm going to ask what that is in the next generation. In the next generation, what is the frequency of big A, big B? Okay. And now what we're going to do is say, okay, let us imagine an individual producing, if I get this right. Here we are at a stage, these are gametes that came together to form a diploid individual. And that diploid individual is going to produce gametes. And I'm going to draw this twice because I'm going to have two different cases here. Okay. Now, I'm looking in the offspring generations, this is generation zero, here's generation one. I'm looking in the gametes. So these are the gametes that form generation zero. These are the gametes that are forming generation one. I've got to keep track of this. There are two cases. One case is that here is the chromosome. We're looking at the chromosome that these things are on. Let's assume they're on the same chromosome. And here are the two chromosomes of that individual, the two members of that chromosome pair. In this parent that was formed by the gametes of generation zero, and now it's going to reproduce. And there are going to be two cases. One is no crossover, or to be more precise, no recombination. There is a difference because you can have, you will remember that recombination occurs as a result of crossing over, but if you can have crossing over, but if you have two of them between the two genes, then there's crossover, but there's no recombination between those two loci. So we're really saying let's forget about crossover for the moment and say no recombination. But there's also the case of recombination between these two loci. And there, what we would have is that the gamete that comes out here might be just one of those two gametes in its entirety, or at least with respect to these two loci. Here, what will come out is a recombination. We'll make it as a single crossover. We'll have the loci be located here. And here, I'm putting little tick marks for the ones that get passed on to the next generation. What's the probability of a recombination between A and B? Well, it's going to be something. We'll just call it R. And 1 minus R of the time, there's no recombination. So R is the recombination fraction expected between those two genes. We're almost to the point I need to get to. So if I want to work out what the P, big A, big B will be in that among those gametes produced by these diploid parents, a fraction 1 minus R of the time, they result from there being no recombination. And they're just taken from a chromosome that's in the parent. What's the probability that in that, which came from one gamete, that there was a big A, big B, that they were a big A and a big B, in terms of the notation I'm using here?
Probability that?
That the two copies, the A copy and the B copy here, which came from here and thus came riding in on the same gamete, what's the probability that they were big A and big B? So if there was no recombination, they're just a copy of a gamete from the previous generation. They were what was carried by one gamete in the previous generation. And didn't we have a name for that? We did. That was P, big A, big B. So this term is just 1 minus R times the previous generation's frequency of big A and big B. This one, here's the hard one, and we're going to expound it next time and continue on from this equation next time. If it's a recombination, the A locus came from one chromosome and the B locus came in on the other gamete. So you'd have to have an A on that gamete and a B on that gamete. Now, what's the probability that if I look at the two gametes that made up this individual, that the left one had an A and the right one had a B? What was the mating system? How are we mating? The answer is random mating. Okay. In the random mating case, when I pick a gamete, say, what's the probability it has a big A on it? If that's all I ask, it's just the gene frequency of big A. What fraction of all gametes? So we'll do a little p, so big A. What's the probability that this contains a b? It's little b, and are we allowed to multiply those? Well, we are, because the two gametes were picked at random from the pot. So here's the basic equation. The haplotype frequency is equal to 1 minus r times the old haplotype frequency plus r times the product of gene frequencies. And we're going to pick up next time and show that there is a measure of association between the two, the genes at the two alleles, that called linkage disequilibrium, and we're going to show how it changes through time as a result of recombination. So I better let you go. And anybody here who signed up for a copy of the book can come on and claim your copy, and the rest of you can envy them.